Please turn off your beepers and cell phones and do not bring any beverages or food into the church. Refreshments must remain in the Duke Room. My name is Amanda, and I am an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA. Since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature person Michael C. and Sue have the list of such groups with their telephone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. And Jamie will read the preamble.
Hi, I'm Jamie. I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
And please join in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Jay will read the steps.
My name is Jay, and I'm an alcoholic. Step one. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10. Continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. And 12. Having had a spiritual awakening, as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Thank you. Andrew will read the traditions.
Hi, I'm Andrew. I'm an alcoholic. The 12 traditions. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as He may express Himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants, they do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6. An AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8. Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9. AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
Thank you, Andrew. The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers followed by our information break, and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Judy.
Hi, my name is Judy. I'm an alcoholic. I'm terrified right now. I found out 20 minutes ago I was going to speak, and I was really scared because I haven't had time to prepare because I'm an alcoholic and I want to come up here and give you the perfect 10-minute qualification so everyone can love me and then tell me how wonderful I am, because that would make me feel whole. Okay, I'm going to start off on what it was like. I come from a long line of alcoholics. I believe that I was born an alcoholic because I was an alcoholic way before I started drinking, because what I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous is that the alcohol was just a symptom. You know, I heard I came here for my drinking and I stayed here for my thinking. Just because I put down the drink about 5 months ago does not make me sober. It would make me dry if I wasn't here. So growing up, I never felt that I fit in. I never liked myself. Since my earliest childhood memories, I was never as good as my sister, I was never good as my brother, not like my cousins. You know, why can't I be like them? Why can't I be better? I was just always angry and so jealous and envious of everybody because they weren't me. And that's really what it came down to. If you weren't me, I hated you, you know, because obviously you were better. I was never comfortable being myself. I had my first drink when I was about 10. It was at a family party, and my cousins dared me to chug a glass of champagne. So I chugged it. My cheeks turned bright red. I fell off my chair. Everybody laughed, thought it was cute, and I was like, ooh, attention. The whole family's looking at me. This is great. Because I always wanted attention. That goes with I always felt that my parents loved my sister more because she was smarter. They liked my brother because he was better in sports. So it was always this constant searching, craving for you to like me, you know, because I couldn't like myself, you know. I would always want everyone else's approval because I never approved of myself. And I don't know where that came from. No one came out and told me that, but I think it's just because, you know, I'm an alcoholic. I got to high school, and I was still, of course, not comfortable, but I thought, oh, high school, now I'm with older people, you know, it'll get better. It was always going to get better. In order for me to live and to go on, I had to have something to look forward to, because otherwise there's nothing to wake up for. So it would always be, okay, I'm going to go to high school. Ooh, I would have this fantasy. It's this new place. There's going to be new people. I'm going to have a chance to start over again so people will like me, and maybe I'll be popular and get a boyfriend. And it was just all this stuff. It was always this disillusionment of what the future could be, because it wasn't in the moment, you know, where I've learned now in sobriety to live one day at a time. And I was like, oh, God, how do you do that? Because it was the moment I'd never liked. So I got to high school, and it was always Monday. Okay, where's the party Friday, Saturday? I got through my week by planning where we were going to go that weekend, what we were going to drink. And I was fortunate enough also that my parents would get me the alcohol. I would lie to them, of course. I would be like, oh, well, there's five of us, so we're going to get a 12-pack, when really it was for, like, me. And they were like, okay. I was just really good at lying. I did this other thing, too, where I would make up stories. And if the story was like somewhat true, I would just sort of glamorize it to make it a little bit better so I could like, and then it was sort of, I didn't know what was real or not because you have to keep up with your stories of what you tell people. So that was basically high school, same thing to college. I was like, oh, college, it's going to get better now, you know, and it was the same pattern. I always was looking forward to the future. I had expectations. They never live up to them. I would go out on the weekend and get drunk. And it was either, it was boys, it was drinks, it was all that. I did a couple of geographics. I went to Maryland. Wasn't good in Maryland. Went to Jersey. No, it wasn't there. I went to Italy. That was fun. Really good food. All that stuff. Still wasn't there. Okay, now I'm going to go to London, you know. And London, what I did, this was in college. I was past the drinking age now. I was like, I'm not going to drink. I'm going to be really sophisticated. And now I'm going to be smart. You know, I'm not going to, people used to call me a lush and a psycho, and I was like, whatever. But that's another thing I did, is sort of, I wore all these masks because I wanted you to tell me who I was. Because I had no clue who I was. I even feel now in sobriety, like, I really still don't know who I am. I'm actually, for the first time in my life, learning who I am. But so it was, I needed you to tell me who I was, so then I could play that part. I was always this, like, actor. I was always trying to control it. So in London, I decided, okay, I'm not going to drink. And what did I do? I sat in my room by myself with the radio in front of me and a glass of tea, because now I had given up coffee, too. I don't know what I was doing. But I was completely lonely, and I would just sit there and write in my journal about how miserable I was. Because I was, you know, an egomaniac with an inferiority complex. And I was like, I'm such a gifted genius, and I'm so creative and so wonderful, but yet how can I be so miserable? Why did God punish me this way? Like, that's how I looked at it. My last night out was, I had already come to this point over the last year where I said, okay, I can't have shots because I black out. Can't have martinis because I black out. And then two times I went out in December. Once I had vodka, and I blacked out. So I said, aha, I get it. Vodka makes me black out because it was vodka martinis and it was vodka shots, so now I'm not going to drink that. So my last night out, I went out, had I don't know how much wine, and then I decided, I went to a bar after, and they said, what do you want? And I said, rum. And then I blacked out. But on this night, I had my moment of clarity, and I was totally touched by God, and I was blessed. And I blacked out, and I came to all the way on the east side. I was walking by myself, don't know what time it was. It was raining. I was crying. I was yelling at nobody there. And somehow, everything was clear. And I was just like, I'm an alcoholic. That's it. I am. I had already taken that test on the AA website, you know, the 20 questions. Every time I would black out and feel guilty in the morning, I would take the test to see if I was an alcoholic because I couldn't believe that I was. So anyway, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I cried through it because I was like, my life is over. This is it. Why am I being punished? I got a sponsor after 4 days. I think I have the best sponsor. But, you know, if you don't think your sponsor is the best, get another one. It's the same thing as your home group. I'm a member of the Atlanta group. I think it's the best group. You know, and if you don't think your home group is the best group, just find another one then that you think is the best group. And when I came in, I went to a meeting every day. Called three other alcoholics a day. Because one of the things that I did is because I'm an alcoholic, I treat my loneliness with isolation. I think I'm special. I thought I was unique. And I was like, nobody has my problems. Nobody understands. Nobody has the feelings that I do. Meanwhile, you know what? I'm just like every single person here in this room. I'm no different. I just look different. But the feelings are all the same, is that I always felt alone, I always felt not good enough, and I always wanted something to fill the hole, when really what I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous is that I need my fellow alcoholics and I need my higher power. And today that's the main difference, is that now I have hope that things are going to get better. Now I can wake up today and say, okay, I'm going to go to work, and then I'm going to go to the Atlantic group meeting. And that's today. And that's all I needed to look forward to, was that I'm going to be home. You know, it's like I finally, and I'm surprised I'm not crying already. It's one of those things where now I can be proud of myself, because I came from this place of, I hated myself. I just really, like, I was so mean to myself. You know, I would never let anyone treat me worse than I treated myself, but I would let people be pretty mean to me because that's what I did to myself. I was the one walking around for years going, you suck, you're no good, people don't like you. All those little voices that are now like, it's the alcoholic. And the alcoholic still hasn't gone away. If I don't call people and if I don't go to a meetings, I start to get crazy because it fights. Like, my alcoholism wants me drunk, and then it wants me dead. You know, and so I have to beat that out. And it's constant. It's a daily thing. I used to get mad in the beginning when I would say, you know, I have to get on my knees every morning and turn my will over to the care of God as I understand him. And then someone said to me, well, you don't get angry that you have to shower or brush your teeth, but yet you're going to get angry that you have to pray every morning. It's the same thing. This program is daily. I'm not going to graduate. I'm on my 6th and 7th step, which the 4th step was really difficult. But I'm so glad that I did it. When I did my 5th step and I had no more secrets, I felt so much lighter because I had nothing to hide anymore. And I didn't feel alone. And now, you know, when I go to bed and I pray again and I thank God for everything that I have, you know, I know that I can look at myself and for the first time in my entire life, I can actually love, not just like. It's a program also that gives you back yourself. You know, that's what the blessing of this program was. You know, it gave me all these wonderful people in my life, but it gave me me. And that's going to change because it's been changing every few months and it's going to keep getting better. And I'm completely amazed by the program. I feel so blessed to have been given it, to have the awareness that, you know what, I'm just an alcoholic. When it comes down to it, I'm just a drunk like everybody else. But I'm actually glad, and I never thought I would say that, but I'm glad that I'm an alcoholic, and I thank you all for being here and listening. Thanks.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Phil.
Hi, I'm Phil. I'm an alcoholic. The Atlanta group is my home group. My sobriety date is February 3rd, 2004, and Amanda is my sponsor, and I'm in step 10. I also never had any doubt about my family history. I also really never had any doubt that I was an alcoholic. From the time I was very young, I saw my father's alcoholism, and I thought that was the way adult men acted. I thought that was what I would grow into, and it never really troubled me particularly. It's a little hard to get at my family history because I come from a Mormon background, so there's not a lot of documentation of drinking, but there is a great-great-grandfather that is a very, very well-documented early Mormon who died of alcohol poisoning at 35, so... It definitely goes in the genes. As you hear many people share from up here, as a child, I was a loner. I did a lot of thinking. I never really felt like I belonged. I most of my childhood memories are of me walking around trying to figure stuff out on my own. You know, alcohol it was really my freshman year of high school. I lived in England with my family just for that 1 year. And, you know, I'd had a few tastes of alcohol before. I don't really remember the first time I ever had a taste of alcohol. But the first time I ever got enough alcohol to feel drunk, I just knew this was the solution for that kind of inner anxiety, that angst, that emptiness that so many of us feel. But circumstances didn't allow for me to get my hands on unlimited quantities for really the time I was in England, though England was a good prep for me because in England, as somebody who's underage, they let you have shandy, which is watered-down beer, because it's cut with lemonade. And, you know, the idea that somebody would grow up and not drink is just not considered. It's just kind of a starter beer for kids. But when I got back to New York, and I grew up here in the city, when I got back to New York, I went into high school, sophomore year, and I was starting all over. It was a whole new group of friends. It was a chance to redefine myself. And I kind of got adopted by one of the cool party kids. So within a month or two of what I think of as my beginning of high school, I went to a party, and it was my first real drunk. It was my first blackout, and it was the beginning of a pattern that was pretty much the same my entire drinking career, which was go to a social event because I want to be a social person, have so much anxiety over being at the social event that I drink as much as possible, blackout. I'm after some kind of abandon, but all I get is oblivion. All I get is I just want to be gone. I'm here, but I don't want to feel anything. So, you know, I usually black out. Sometimes I pass out, and I don't remember anything anyway. That was the first drunk I ever had. By the spring of that year, within 4 or 5 months of school, I had dropped out of high school. I was just hanging out in front of the high school. My parents found out that I dropped out of high school, so they threw me out. So at 15, I was on the streets. And really, it seemed normal to me. It seemed perfectly rational that I had disobeyed the rules of the household, so I wasn't allowed to live there, and that was just my life. I found the music scene, the downtown punk scene, and that kind of spoke to my angst, my anger. The first time I ever went to a club, I went to see a happy power pop band. I went to see Blondie, and the opening act was Suicide, which any of you know. If you don't, I'm there for the first time at a club. I'm 16, I think, and drinking, and people are throwing stuff at the stage, and the lead singer reaches down and picks up a broken glass and cuts his face, and I'm like, I'm home. This is, you know, this is the expression of how I feel. So I rode that wave for a long time. I worked for bands, and I got involved in the music scene, went on tours and stuff. And then friends started dropping dead right and left for a variety of reasons. And I got a little scared. And by that time, I had gotten into a relationship. I was a roadie for a band, and the lead guitarist kind of picked me up, and she and I got married and moved to Pennsylvania. We ran away. We did a geographic, and then we got sober together. This was when I was 23. And I thought that was that. I thought my drinking career was over. Never did any step work, never got a sponsor, arrived late, left early to meetings, and even though I was going to about a meeting a day, I didn't really ever taste the solution. The damage had been reduced because I wasn't drinking, so I wasn't causing as much wreckage, but I was not a happy person. After 6 years, it just didn't seem like I understood why I was in the program, and I drifted away. There's a lot of reasons to point to, but I think not having a sponsor, never having worked the steps, and avoiding fellowship and service probably had something to do with it. And I'd like to say I realized my mistake soon and came right back, but it took me 12 years. In that time, my best solution before I got really in trouble with drinking again, my best solution was that I was living at a Camaldolese monastery preparing to become a monk. Because it seemed like dropping out of, no judgment about that, but leaving society completely was the best solution in my mind, which really is not that different from being alone in my apartment a couple of years ago, totally isolated, not leaving for 4 or 5 days in a row. Isolation and oblivion were my solutions to not having the ability to deal with society. So, long story short, those 12 years out were pretty much the same as the earlier escapades. 2.5 years ago, or 2 years ago, February, I woke up one morning from a blackout with cuts and bruises, not remembering what I'd done, and something just clicked, and I just said, you know, here we go again. It's going to be, you know, 6 months or less before I was also like 3 months late on the rent, I think. I realized I was very close to kind of falling off the edge again. Two of my best friends were in the program. One of them I'd known since I was 14. I gave him a call. I gave them both calls. He took me to a meeting to Alive Again. That was February 3rd, 2004. I've been sober ever since, and my commitment to do things differently has always been there, but it's my understanding that has changed a few times. At first, I was concerned with just starting the step work and getting a sponsor, and I did that. And that took me up into step four. But then I really didn't want to do step four, and my sponsor wasn't pushing me to do it. So next thing I knew, I'd been sitting on step four for a year. And I don't recommend that to anyone. It's not a very comfortable place to be, but I was filling up my kind of sense of accomplishment by taking on too many service commitments, and I was full of AA. Everybody thought I was a great AA model. But, you know, I didn't really have any of the solution yet. I don't want to overstate that. I mean, I was doing a lot better, but, last year I knew something needed to be done. I found a sponsor, from the Atlantic Group, and I finished my fourth step, did my fifth step, and, you know, kind of buckled under, getting things done. A friend had suggested to me that even though I wasn't in step 11 yet, maybe I should start praying every morning. And I started doing that. And that's when everything started to really shift. I did step 6 and 7, and I started to really see the promises come true in my life. I started to realize that I had never, you know, they say you'll be able to look the world in the eye, look people in the eye. Realized I'd never been able to do that. I prided myself on being honest, but I had so much inner scheming going on, and I reached a level of feeling free that I had never known was possible once I got to that point in the step work. To the newcomer, I just encourage you to get an interim sponsor as soon as possible and just start doing the work. The promises do come true if you do the work. That's the main thing I learned from the 6 years before, is if you don't do the work, they don't come true. And I'm sometimes reluctant to talk about having gone out and stayed out and made it back, because I don't want people to feel like it's okay to go out. But that's my story, and the real promise is that if you do the work, it will happen. So thank you.
Board. Our main speaker tonight is Ava.
Hi, everybody. I'm Ava, and I'm an alcoholic. It's great to be here. Thank you, Vince, for inviting me to speak. This is my home group, so it's always extra special to speak in front of the group and to see all my friends. Welcome to the newcomers, or the not-so-new, in need of a little boost. Welcome. I understand what that's like, too. I have alcoholism, not alcoholism. And welcome to our visitors. It's great to have you in our group. I've been a member of the Atlantic Group for about 9 years. And I had 9 years of sobriety when I came. And I had a lot of... I was sober and very happy in my life. And I had... you know, done a lot of work already. And so it's, a lot of times we hear stories of people that were wandering around aimlessly in recovery, and then that's why they're very excited about the group, because that happens too. And then they find this group, which has a lot of structure, and it really helps them to embrace sobriety, like what Phil was talking about. And what happened for me was, even though I had sobriety and I was already very comfortable in my life and I had a great foundation, when I came to this group and became a part of what you all do, my life exploded in a way. And I was like, lost at sea, so to speak. I never had a home group like this, because it's just not how AA was, or my experience of AA was in New York City, because it's a city, and it's not as home groupy as suburbs are. Our AA is a little different here. At least that was my experience. And I wandered around. I had groups that I frequented, and I would go to every week, and I would call them a home group. However, in retrospect, this is very, very different. I'm very grateful for this, because it took my experience of my life and my recovery to a whole nother level, and I'm very grateful for this group. That's why I'm such a fan of what we do, because of what it's done for me and what I watch it do for all of you in your lives. So I'm really grateful to be here tonight. So thank you, Vince. And I have relationships with all of you people. I mean, that's amazing, because you know who I was I had a smile on my face, but if I had a problem with you, or if I had my feelings hurt, or if I felt awkward, I would take my ball and go home. And to be in one home group for 9 years without being arrested for manslaughter or suicide is really a credit to this program, because it's hard. People are difficult, and they're messy, and they're annoying. And thank God this is, and what does that have to do with alcoholism? Everything, because that's exactly the whole thing. I have a living problem, and alcohol was my solution to my living problem, and I have alcoholism, and then the very thing that was my solution turned on me, because alcoholism is a progressive disease, and it left me in a place where alcohol no longer worked as a solution, and it was now the problem as well. And I had two problems. I couldn't drink, and I couldn't not drink, and I couldn't live. And that is really a terrible place to be. And it is the greatest gift that I ever received, was to be in that, backed into that corner of having nowhere else to go but AA. And then being led here, which is a tremendous gift, because a lot of people are in that corner, and they, for whatever reason, they don't get the gift of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't understand that, and that is a heartbreak to me. I'm a nice Jewish girl from Brooklyn. To the best of my knowledge, we have no alcoholism in my family, so I'm breaking all the alleged. I do believe if you take Judy's story and Phil's story, put it in a blender and add a disco ball, you have my story. If people are born with this disease, I believe that I had the disease. All I needed was to do was to add alcohol. I needed a drink in the third grade. What I had a lot of self-centered fear. I'm the very fear-based personality type. Versus the resentful, angry, out type. I'm the more resentful toward myself, depressive type. So my anger goes in and I get very depressed. Underneath all of that is a lot of fear. I'm very uncomfortable in my own skin, although you wouldn't know that from looking at me, because I'm very, very social, very busy, very outgoing. I'm in the middle of everything, but inside my skin is, you know, my skin's crawling, and I'm paranoid to the that I'm paranoid, thinking you really don't like me. I can't, and that's that self-centered fear. I can't think my way out of it. And when I was a kid, and I would be on the bus, I would be afraid to call out back door, because I was afraid the whole bus would turn and look at me. That's self-centered fear. I lived in the center of the universe. That's how it felt. That's how I experienced life. It's very crowded there. And that's why I needed a drink. And I didn't get one until I was about 14 or 15 years old, and it was way overdue. And my whole story is in the name of a good time and about being cool. And I don't know, a hanky and pearls. I don't know how cool that is. I guess it's cool when you're 50. This is what 50 and fabulous looks like, okay? So it started with very humble beginnings, you know, the garage band. It was really, you know, and what did we drink? Boone's Farm and Ripple. I mean, that was our drink of choice. It's very hard to get your hands on alcohol, so you have to steal it as a kid. So it's a lot easier to get illegal drugs, and I have a lot of that in my story. And I didn't realize I was alcoholic, and there's so much denial about alcoholism in my own story. I mean, I was a daily drinker by the time I was 16 years old. I was in a cycle of spree and remorse. I was lying to myself every day to get myself a drink, to go drink with the gang, whoever that gang was. I would drink, I would hang out with boys, I would do things with them in the hopes that they would like me. I had this crazy idea that if I did things, they would like me, because I'm like Judy. I need your approval so desperately. I don't know why that is. I have this incredible emptiness. I don't understand what that is. I'm not going to even bother analyzing it. I believe it's the core of my alcoholism, so that's why I call it alcoholism. I call it the unwellness. I call it the disease. That excessive low self-esteem. I mean, low self-esteem would be a step up. I don't feel this way anymore, which is good news. But how I felt about myself like I'm a zero. I'm nothing. That's really painful, and I believe that to be true. I don't anymore because of the work that has occurred, the miracles that have occurred in my life. But it's mind-boggling to me because then I look now, I don't understand it. I don't understand why. And I felt like a zero. And so I would do whatever I thought I needed to do to get you to like me and to love me. Like me, like me, love me, love me. And so I was the cool and fabulous. Everything is about being fabulous and the life of the party. And I drank to feel more. Like I wanted to, some people drink to shut down. I did that later on. But initially I drank to even feel more, you know, because I wanted like that rush of having fun. And I fun my way right off the planet. But, you know, drinking in cars with boys or whatever, I mean, that's like my story. And what I was in a cycle of spree and remorse. I would drink, hang out, participate in things that I did and didn't want to do, get up, be full of self-hatred, swear off. By noon, I'm feeling better. I can't really remember. By 2 o'clock, I'm making plans. By 4 o'clock, I'm lying to my mother every day. I'm a teen alcoholic, and I don't even know it. And then through a series of events, a lot of my story, I discovered a lot of other drugs that worked beautifully in my body. They don't work for everybody else, but they're part of my story, and I went off on a tear. And had the alcohol not did for me what it did for me, I would have never opened the door for anything else. So alcohol led me to drugs, and eventually drugs led me back to a drink, and that's what my alcoholism looks like. So I was stoned on something from the time I began until the doors of detox in 1988, and I just call it my alcoholism, and that's my story. So it was one thing after another. I was a big disco girl. It was all about the clubs and dancing. I love to dance. We danced the hustle. It was the dance of the day. I still dance, but I'm a much better dancer today because stoned on Quaaludes on a platform shoe, you can't do a triple spin right off the shoe. Much better to dance sober. And then the other piece of my best friend in high school was gay, and he trained me for clubbing. I mean, we didn't go to school. We practiced dancing in his room because in my day, you had to be fabulous before you got to the dance floor. They're much more politically correct and friendly now. They won't kick you out of the club if you're a dancer in training. But in my day, you better be, you know, buttoned up to the nines before you step foot on the dance floor. And then nobody would dance with you if they didn't know that you could dance. It was this vicious cycle, which only created, and you can imagine in my head with the self-centered fear that I had, what was going on. I was just loaded, all this loaded. So I would go with him to the gay bars and then with my friends to the straight clubs, dancing my way around the universe. And I had a lot of fun. In the early days, it was fun. I was young. I could drink. I could stay up for days at a time. I could still go to work. I could do different things. But eventually, burning the candle on both ends caught up with me. And so I have a lot of club, you know, I was the club kid before they existed. We set the tone, so you can thank me after the meeting. Anyway, what happened was, in the name of a good time and being cool, I just abandoned. I had hopes of going to medical school when I was a kid. And I just threw that stuff away because hanging out at the student union building and wearing bell-bottom hip huggers was much more important to me and being in the middle of everything. I went to work young and I had a promise of a good career because I was I'm talented. I'm very talented when I work. I'm talented. I'm personable. I'm likable. I'm a a victim of potential. But what my alcoholism got in the way. I chose drinking and everything else over working. And I became unemployable. So I dropped out of school, I dropped out of work, and I dropped right off the earth. And the progression took a hold of me, and I was just reduced to a shell of a human being. So I, through a series of events, my girlfriends, you know, I did time on Long Island in the clubs with the girls with the big hair and the nails, my beautiful girlfriends in Long Island clubs. My girlfriend staged an intervention, and they convinced me to get help. And I'm in their house. I'm in the one girlfriend's house, and they have all these. They spent a whole week gathering information. My beautiful friends, none of them are alcoholic. The one girlfriend, party girl. She could go shot for shot, dance for dance. But she did this ridiculous thing. At 4 o'clock, she has enough, she goes home. What is that? It's ridiculous. Anyway, they staged this intervention to try and get me to see the light. And they convinced me after we're going around and around in circles. I'm in belligerent denial. Yeah, but I know what I, you know. Yeah. Yeah, talk to the hand. I know what I'm doing. Yeah, but, I mean, you know, but finally I say, okay, give me the number. I'll call. So I get on the phone and I call a helpline and one of us answers the phone. And we cut right through, you know, all this stuff. It's amazing how we can talk to each other. She wasn't even eyeball to eyeball. She was on a phone. I knew she knew. She knew that I knew that she knew. And it was, you know, so I didn't even bother lying to her, I'm not a good liar. I'm not a good liar. I feel conflicted if I throw gum on the floor. I'm one of those that I'm like a pathological honest person. And so I'm so conflicted when I'm not. That's why I need doubles when I lie. I'm not good at lying. So I get her on the phone and I tell the truth about my history, and she says to me, people like you with a history like yours don't go to a meeting and the problem is solved. Because I said, okay, I'll go to a meeting. Like I'm going to give them a meeting. Like big of me. And she said, you know, this is much more serious than you realize. And I had this moment of clarity. This absolute moment of clarity, and I saw my problem for what it really was. I saw that I was an alcoholic and a drug addict, and that if I didn't do something big, that this was not going away. I was in big trouble. And I became willing to ask for help. And I don't know, and I had this feeling once I admitted that I have this problem, and I became willing to ask for help, I had this feeling that my problem was solved. And I felt this weight lift off my chest. And it was just a remarkable thing. And I didn't do that. It was done for me. And I don't even understand what that is. I call that the grace of God, because it did not come from my ego or the great Ava. It came from something greater than me. I call that the grace of God, because one minute I was belligerent and the next minute I was willing. And that is an amazing gift. Even though the willingness was tiny, I could work with that. And I did. And I went in to my friends and I surrendered to my friends and I told them I was willing to get help. And within, by Tuesday, I wound up in this rehab detox facility, mental institution, club, disco, and that's where my journey began. That's where I met the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and all the fellowships, and that's where my journey began. And I'm very grateful for that place, because they prepared us for AA. They saved me a lot of grief. So I'm very great. I'm a success story of treatment. They saved me a lot of in and out, because I did not understand. I did not know what was wrong with me. I didn't understand what alcoholism was. I did not understand. I just really didn't get it. I woke up that first morning in this detox, and I said, what happened? Like, what happened? How did I get here? How did I get here? Well, I drank my way there, but I didn't get it. And they explained that, you know, that alcoholism is a disease, and the spiritual answer is that it's just an unwellness that comes to some people, and I have it. Why me? You know, that whole arm wrestling with the why me? Why am I an alcoholic? Why do I have this? Why that? And I don't have alcoholism in my immediate family that we know of, so here I am thinking there's a mistake. You know, but you know what? I identified with the people, and every night AA would bring in a meeting, and that was the highlight of the day, and I identified with the people. And I had this aha experience of knowing that we were the same. And I figured if they could do it, I could do it. And so basically they said, you know, go out. When you get out of this place, come to a meeting and, you know, get a sponsor, get a home group, blah, blah, blah. And actually in the, you know, on the first day of treatment, I sashay into the day room in my, you know, T-shirt from my club, you know, of what, you know, and I met Craig. Craig was a nice Jewish gay boy from Queens, and he had been in rehab for 3 weeks, and he knew everything about recovery. And the truth of the matter is that Craig knew enough about recovery to carry the message to me, and to help me take the next action that I needed to take to get sober. And Craig picked me up on the day I was released and escorted me to my first meeting. And I have been sober one day at a time ever since. And that was March of 1988. And I made a commitment to, that was a big action. It's about the actions that we take. Continuous action. When I was new, I couldn't rely on my thinking. My thinking was completely insane. But it was the sober actions. I could rely on your thinking to teach me what the right actions were that I needed to take. And I followed your suggestions. And I got very involved in the program. I made a meeting a day, if not two. Actually, I wasn't working. I was unemployable. I made two or three meetings a day. I went to the same meetings. I got myself a sponsor. I got service commitments. I began to pray to the best of my ability. I didn't feel very well. I couldn't work. I was up most of the night. My body clock was in reverse. I was really very sick from this disease. I was very, very, very destroyed from this disease. It took me a really long time. I lived at home with my parents for the first 2 years of my sobriety. I was not happy about that. And you know, it's amazing. Sobriety has worked wonders on me. My parents are the most adorable, okay? Some of you might have met them. I had a big birthday party, and they were at the party. They are adorable. Now, I did not think they were adorable my entire life, nor did I think they were adorable when I was newly sober and living in the house, okay? Because I didn't get it. Like, I really was unwell. I was so didn't get it. In retrospect, I was living in a treasure chest with jewels. That's who they are. But my self-centeredness and my inability to see the truth about my own life is such that I can't see the truth. I'm a little demented. I'm much better now. But my thinking was completely whack. And one of the first spiritual experiences that I had in early sobriety is when I realized, oh my God, my thinking is faulty. My thinking is faulty. My thinking is faulty because up until that point, I thought if my thinking is correct, I'm really in big trouble because you should hear what goes on in my head. But when I realized, oh my God, my thinking is faulty. I could work with that. I can work with that. And I realized that I couldn't rely on my own thinking and that God could and would restore me to sanity if he was sought and I was going to follow your direction. And that's what I sought out to do. And it's been quite the journey in recovery. I, of course, became the queen of service. It's very suited to my personality. Look at me, I'm doing service. Let me get more approval and affirmation from as many people as possible. But you know what? Overcommitting to service has never got me drunk. I've been in the middle of AA because I've been looking for speakers. to take to my detox commitment all these years of sobriety. And it really changed my, turned my life around. What I did, I had this amazing, very, my first sponsor was this beautiful young girl, Valerie. And I still had a lot of denial about my alcoholism. I didn't really get it. I mean, I was so mocus when I was new. I didn't really understand what was going on. I just brought, bring the body, the mind will follow, they said, because I couldn't even really work steps very deeply because my, I had no awareness. I didn't even know who I was or where I was. I just knew I had two feelings. I feel fabulous or horrible. I didn't even get it, so I had to clear up a lot. So my first, I got a sponsor and I did the steps to the best of my ability. It was almost like, you know, see Ava drink. My fourth step should have been hieroglyphics. It doesn't matter. I did what I could. That's the point. Do what you can. And Valerie was a young girl. She had gotten sober when she was 16. And by the time I came around, she was 18, and she had 2 years of recovery. And she took me through my first fourth and fifth step, and we were working together for a little while, and then she got the crazy notion in her head that she was really just a crazy young person who had gotten involved with the wrong people and that she wasn't really an alcoholic. But what had happened was I'd been working with her, and she'd been sponsoring me, and I said, oh, no, no, you don't understand. You are me. You've been listening to my story. I am you with another 17 years. Don't move. You know, you don't understand. And what I realized, she couldn't hear me. But what happened was I realized that I was the real thing, alcoholic, at her age. And the book talks about how we can go back over our drinking careers and we can look back in an earlier progression of our alcoholism and we could see where we were gone beyond recall way before we started to experience some of these awful consequences. And that's what happened to me. I said, oh, my God. She's me. I'm alcoholic. I'm the real thing. You know, in AA we say, once a pickle, never a cucumber. But I couldn't see how I had been a pickle at 16. But when I saw myself in her and in her story, and when she said, oh, no, but I was like, oh, no, you're not. And I realized I was talking to myself. She couldn't hear me, and she left the program. Thankfully, she returned some years later. But I stayed. And that's what happened for me, where I really, really earned my seat. And I really got that I really have this disease. In the book, it talks about we have to concede to our innermost selves that we're bodily and mentally different from our fellows on that really deep level. I just keep staying really close to AA, staying in the center of AA, doing the work the best I can and working hard with others. And whatever I can't see in myself, you mirror back to me. That's how it works. I do the best I can in the steps with who I can see, working at myself, and it's in my efforts to help you and to help you get better that I get to claim the rest of me. And it's been, what an amazing journey. I mean, it's just unbelievable. I have a wonderful sponsor I met at Sober Club Med. She's just a beautiful example of AA in this program and what emotional sobriety really looks like in life, when life on life's terms really comes down the pike. Sometimes life is tough. We got a lot going on in our sober family. It's not always easy. There are different points in time in my sobriety where I was depressed or I was disappointed in life. Everything just doesn't, like, I had a lot of fantasy thinking or magical thinking when I was young, young in the program, I always say, thinking, now that I'm sober, everything's going to be okay. Well, on one level, that is absolutely true. If I'm sober and I stay close to all of you, I am okay in a certain way. On that regard, and real wellness of life. It doesn't mean, though, that I'm never going to have to deal with life on life's terms, or illness, or difficulty, or loneliness, or heartbreak, or financial insecurity, or problems dealing with people, or relationships, or health, or any of that. It means that I'll have tools to navigate through all of those things, remain reasonably balanced, and take care of myself as I go along and the people around me. That's what it means to me. And that's amazing. And there is a level of life that I did not know was available for living until I just just kept practicing these principles in all my affairs, and to keep taking my own inventory, and to keep doing the work in the steps, and to keep making amends wherever I can, and to keep taking my inventory and not yours, because I'm very good. I can take your inventory very well. I had to learn how to take mine with precision clarity so I can ask God for help. And it's not that I have to, it's I can. I think that's the main thing. I used to say, oh my God, I have to go to meetings, I have to do this. I can do this. I can go to meetings. This is a gift. In A Vision for You, it talks about how in our book we come to a place where we no longer do this because we have to. We do this because we want to. And that's what has happened for me. The program's changed me. I'm much lighter. I'm different. I'm different. I'm different with me. I probably was much very nice to you. Probably the person with whom I've had the most change is the way that I relate with myself. Not in that self-centered way, but really in just a balanced, well way. And the way I take care of myself and the way that I speak to myself. Because I was very nasty to myself. Sister Maurice always says, when you're talking to yourself, watch your mouth. And this program has taught me that, because it'd be very quick to hurt myself. That's who I am, and I don't do that anymore. I don't do that anymore. I recently told my sponsee that I'm very big on steps 7 through 12. So there's a lot of, I'm big on all the steps. A lot of focus on, 1 through, doing inventory. My big push is on really taking the tools that we learn for self-examination, prayer, and service, and really putting the push on that stuff in my life, in the daily life, and to really capitalize on these opportunities to see what stuff within me is still standing in my way between me and you, which is between me and God. I mean, it's a very practical program, really practical. It's a design for living that works for people like us. I never have to drink, I never have to use, and I don't have to live, which I sometimes have, in that misery and self-centered loneliness and apartness that I lived in my whole life until I found you. And I want to thank you for my life.